In the mid-1980s, the NYPD found themselves in the middle of an intense and frustrating manhunt. On May 25, 1985, Janet Scott was discovered brutally murdered in her hotel apartment. Her killer, striking with a horrifying fury and wielding an axe-like weapon, committed such a heinous crime, it gripped the city in fear. While police hoped it would be an isolated incident, only 5 days would pass before it happened again. 58-year-old Ruth Potdevin walked into her fifth-floor room at the glamorous Dorset Hotel and never walked out. When her husband went to check, he discovered her much like Janet had been found. For the second time in a week, an unsuspecting woman had been slain by an axe-wielding killer. While police didn't want to create more fear, they had no choice but to acknowledge the likelihood that both women had been killed by the same person. This was confirmed not only by the manner in which they were killed, but also through a cryptic and gruesome puzzle left behind at both scenes, one made of blood and bone in what police referred to as a dark ritual, whose meaning is known only to the killer. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 140, The New York City Hotel Axe Murders. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine a set of terrifying murders that, despite their horror, have been mostly forgotten. Before getting into that, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. The show is also available on MeWe and Minds. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon available at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions directly through the website or email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Two women brutally murdered in Manhattan hotels. 35 years later, and barely a whisper of the case is ever uttered. This is episode 140, The New York City Hotel Axe Murders. Every year, more than 65 million people choose New York City to be their destination for vacation. Living now, in the age of Airbnb, there's a lot more options of places to stay during that time, be they cheaper, closer to the sites a person wishes to see, or maybe just more convenient. For those who seek the full service, to look out over the city from a high-rise hotel, they've got more than a few options. There's 460 hotels in Manhattan alone, offering everything from a taste of the opulent lifestyle to the more financially conservative. While many view hotels as a means to an end, others choose to indulge in the amenities available to them: room service, laundry, daily housekeeping. While a hotel, for the majority, is a limited stay, there are those who choose to make a hotel their permanent residence, at least as permanent as one can be. That may seem a bit strange to some, but in many ways it makes a lot of sense for a lot of different people. One important detail to note is that while rent for an apartment in New York City can really hammer your wallet, the average cost in 2019 was $3,500 a month, if you're willing to sacrifice some of that luxury, you could spend less than half of that, as little as $1,700 a month, renting and re-renting a hotel room each month. As you'd imagine, this can come with both bonuses and drawbacks: less privacy, the complication of noisy neighbors, and the absence of a communal atmosphere, what with so many people staying only for a few days or weeks. There are perks, though. For some, they don't own many possessions and feel no need to set down permanent roots, or maybe they lack the ability to. Why buy a television, bedding, and furniture when your room will not only include them, but oftentimes the quality will be superior to what you could afford in the first place? In some cases, it's a conscious choice, a decision considered and weighed. In others, it's out of necessity. an inability to afford a more permanent residence, or physical limitations on one's ability to keep a living space neat and orderly can surely result in a permanent stay. According to some studies, though, there are those who simply find a hotel they love, and having no other plans, they just choose to stay there. When you imagine staying in a hotel in New York, there are certain things that come to mind. Quick access to all the city has to offer, beautiful views of Central Park or the ocean, sleek accommodations, 24-hour concierge service, and delicious meals tucked beneath a silver cloche brought straight to your door, steaming hot. In the end, it's all about atmosphere and feeling like, for that period, be it a day, a week, or a year, you are a respected guest. There is, of course, a concerning side to all of it. Leaving valuable items out while exploring the city or attending a convention can be a little worrisome. Some hotels, though, offer safes or other measures to further secure your belongings, but what about other guests? Being surrounded by strangers, never really sure who you're sharing walls with, can be disconcerting. Those doors, no matter how secure, always feel somehow less safe than the locks on your own home. But no matter how many times you've checked in, it's unlikely you've ever been tremendously worried about surviving to conclude your stay. Unfortunately, during one week in the spring of 1985, a violent and brutal killer brought that possibility sharply into focus and created a new meaning behind the city that never sleeps. 85-year-old Janet Baker Scott had been living on the 7th floor of the Bryant Hotel for years. Manhattan Chief of Detectives Joseph Borelli described her time living there to the Weekly World News, calling it uneventful. Janet lived alone in room 717 and had done so for at least the previous few years, seemingly without incident. According to a hotel employee who chose to remain nameless, single rooms at the Bryant were available for between $25 and $35 a day. Janet seems, for the most part, to have gone mostly unnoticed, a quiet, elderly woman spending her retirement years in the small living space at 230 West 54th Street. Unfortunately, there isn't a great deal of information available about Janet's life, though New York State records indicate she was born on July 29, 1901. Janet was the second daughter born to George and Lelia Scott. She had an older sister, Helen, who, according to census data, was born in Glens Falls, a city in Warren County, New York, on May 7, 1898. There don't appear to be any records showing that Janet had ever been married or had children. As much as the details surrounding the final moments of her life remain a mystery, so it seems the story of her life is just as elusive. Janet, who had several nieces and nephews, had been in contact with at least one. Officer Norris Holloman, a spokesman for the New York Police Department, told the New York Times Janet was last seen alive by hotel staff at approximately 6 p.m. on Wednesday, May 22nd. Over the course of the next few days, Janet's niece, who was living in Virginia at the time and is never named in any article, made several phone calls to her aunt, which went unanswered. Finally, concerned for her well-being, Janet's niece arrived in New York City on Saturday, May 25th. At approximately 1 p.m., the niece entered room 717 of the Bryant Hotel and made a horrifying discovery. Janet was lying face down in a pool of blood. Her room, normally well-maintained, appeared to have been ransacked. Police arriving on the scene would describe the crime as both brutal and grisly. It was made clear that Janet had suffered severe trauma to her head, and while an exact determination could not be made, it was believed she had likely been dead for at least 2 days. While no specifics were given, Chief Borelli did tell reporters that it appeared a robbery had taken place and several personal valuables had been stolen, although money and jewelry had been left behind. Examination of the scene did not appear to suggest any struggle had taken place, and police were inclined to believe that either Janet caught the killer by surprise, or vice versa, and then things turned violent. It has since been surmised that Janet, at her age and described as frail, likely wouldn't have put up much of a struggle against her stronger attacker. Perhaps the most disturbing detail about the crime is not how Janet was killed, though that in and of itself is a gruesome tale, but more so what the killer did after Janet had been murdered. According to multiple articles, an unnamed NYPD source explained that the killer had performed a ritual in which splintered pieces of the victim's skull and scalp, including tufts of hair, were arranged into some kind of a pattern, which police believe may hold some significance to the killer. While investigators did attempt to determine a motive for the bizarre postmortem act, they never did nail down exactly what that purpose or meaning was, or at least if they did, they never shared it. An autopsy later determined that Janet had been killed by multiple blows to the head delivered by a heavy bladed instrument thought to have either been an axe, hatchet, meat cleaver, or machete. Whatever the weapon used may have been, it was not located at the scene, which would imply that the killer likely brought it and took it with him. Considering the extensive brutality of the murder, it's difficult to imagine the suspect could have simply strode out of the hotel and back onto the streets of Manhattan without being noticed. By all rights, there should have been blood all over him, not to mention the weapon he had wielded, and yet canvassing by detectives failed to turn up anyone who had seen anything suspicious in the days leading up to the discovery of Janet's body. Investigators were shocked by the crime, both in terms of its brutality and the location in which it occurred. Typically, someone looking to commit a robbery is going to target an area in which he believes he can achieve the highest value. So going after an elderly woman living in a $25 a night room doesn't make much sense. Of course, it was considered possible that the killer may also have been staying at that hotel, or maybe worked there. In their attempt to narrow down the scope of the investigation, police performed interviews with all employees and former employees who had left the job within the previous months. In addition to that, they worked to track down anyone who had stayed at the Bryant in the 6 months leading up to the murder. Despite their efforts, they weren't able to find anyone who drew their suspicions. Local papers didn't cover Janet's case very extensively, though they surely committed some effort to sensationalizing the crime. And within 48 hours, there were warnings about an inhuman savage stalking the streets of Manhattan with an axe. For police, they thought the crime was likely isolated, the result of a rage killer who had been caught in the act and lashed out violently. In terms of the so-called ritual which had been performed, there weren't many insights given. Police stuck to their clinical descriptions for the most part, while simultaneously trying to assure the city that they had the matter under control and were working to track the killer down. 5 days later, though, that narrative would be shattered. Ruth Hauser was born on April 25, 1927, in Great Neck, New York, to parents Mildred Hannah Armstrong and George Henry Hauser. Ruth grew up in Garden City, New York, alongside her older brother, George Jr. The family would spend summers on Long Island's North Fork, enjoying the Great Peconic Bay. Ruth went on to attend Connecticut College in New London, where she was elected to Phi Beta Kappa before graduating in 1949. On April 28, 1951, she married Robert Pott Devon, with whom she would have 4 children, 3 sons and 1 daughter. Robert was the president of both the Pott Devon Export Company and the Pott Devon Machine Company, both based out of Teterboro. Ruth was an accomplished tennis player and was very involved in school activities while her children were young enough to attend. She also volunteered for a number of civic organizations and was a member of the College Club of Ridgewood, New Jersey, where she moved with her husband in 1953. In 1985, Ruth was 58 years old with 4 children and 5 grandchildren. During the week of May 26th, Ruth accompanied Robert into New York to attend a convention for the packing machinery manufacturers. The convention was scheduled to take place at the Dorset Hotel, located at 30 West 54th Street, just a few blocks from the Bryant. While the two hotels may have been close in proximity, they were vastly different in style, with multiple articles referring to the Dorset as luxurious and posh. At the time, the Dorset stood near the Museum of Modern Art, though nothing remains of the original structure today. The hotel hit its peak in the mid-80s, noted as being the location for media magnates and famous celebrities to have power breakfasts and broker deals. Of course, it would also become infamous during Ruth's fateful visit. On the morning of Thursday, May 30th, Ruth elected to go shopping with the wife of another convention attendee while their husbands were busy. Arriving back at the Dorset just prior to noon, Ruth elected to take the elevator up to her fifth floor room, number 527, to change clothes for lunch while her companion went to the front desk to get a key to her room. When Ruth's friend finished her tasks and freshened up in her own room, she picked up the phone and called over to arrange to head down to lunch together, but there was no answer. Assuming Ruth was busy, the woman waited a few moments and then called again, but again, there was no answer. At this point, she assumed Ruth may have gone ahead without her, so the woman went down to lunch with the group, but was surprised to see Robert sitting by himself. At that time, she approached and inquired as to where Ruth had gone. Robert had last seen her when she was going upstairs, so he decided to go up and check on her. At approximately 12:45 p.m., Robert found the door to their room slightly ajar. Pushing it open, he rushed in and saw Ruth lying face down on the floor next to the bed. She was surrounded by a puddle of blood, and it was obvious that she was dead. Robert immediately picked up the phone and had the front desk call for the police. Investigators arriving on the scene immediately noted the similarities between Ruth and Janet's murders. As had previously been the case, Ruth had sustained massive head trauma from a heavy, bladed weapon. An autopsy would later confirm that Ruth had suffered as many as 40 blows, predominantly focused on the back of her head. The damage had been so extensive that newspapers originally reported that she had been shot. Disturbingly, as had been the case with Janet, the killer had once again conducted his so-called ritual, arranging fragments of her skull, scalp, and hair into a sort of pattern. Whether or not the pattern mirrored that which had been created with Janet has never been stated, but it seems enough to remark that the behavior was a key indicator to the police that they were likely looking for the same killer. Despite this knowledge, police initially told reporters the cases were not connected. It wouldn't be until well over a week later that police publicly confirmed that connection did exist. As had been the case with Janet, police believe Ruth had likely walked in on a robbery and fallen victim to the killer, who was either surprised by her arrival or perhaps waiting for it. Beyond the obvious similarities, police also stated that neither woman had been sexually assaulted, and in neither case did they see evidence of a struggle. Detectives noted that Ruth's purse had been gone through, and while no particular items were specified, once again it was said that personal items had been taken, while cash and jewelry had been ignored. We do know for sure at least one item stolen was one of Ruth's credit cards. While the murders had been extremely vicious, police still felt the killing had not been the original goal. Chief Borelli explained to the Weekly World News, quote, "As far as we can tell, the motive for these brutal murders was simple robbery," end quote. The media wanted answers. Was there an axe-wielding serial killer hunting for victims in New York hotels? Detective Charles Prestia wasn't ready to confirm anything, noting that crime in that particular area had actually been down as of late. Whether it be the fancy rooms of the Dorset or the more cost-effective ones of the Bryant, Prestia explained, quote, "You can never figure where something like this is going to happen. For the husband, who sees his wife go up to change, and an hour later she's dead, it's quite a tragic thing," end quote. In hopes of tracking down a suspect, police organized a special 10-member task force to lead the investigation. Police, though, would not reveal the existence of the task force until the time that they publicly confirmed the murders to be connected, approximately 9 days after Ruth was killed. Early on, everyone working for both hotels, as well as everyone who had been staying in them, was questioned by detectives. In Ruth's case, police tracked down and interviewed everyone who had rented the same rooms as the Potdevins for up to a month prior to the murder. In all instances, police requested fingerprints, which seems to suggest they either have the killer's prints or they were working to create elimination prints to try and narrow that down. The details regarding the murders were also entered into a national database to try and determine if the MO fit any other recorded crimes. 3 days after Ruth's murder on Sunday, June 2nd, police had their first and really only break in the case, so to speak. Now, before I get into this, I want to be very clear. Of the limited articles and information available, there are essentially three different descriptions of what happened, and I'll address each variable as we come to it. According to the New York Daily News, two individuals walked into a store in Times Square and attempted to purchase a Walkman with Ruth's missing credit card. The article goes on to explain that the police had sent a notice to the card company whereby if anyone tried to use it, the bank was to immediately notify authorities. There must have been some kind of miscommunication, though, as according to the Daily News, when the store clerk called in to check the card, the bank employee told him it was stolen. After waiting several minutes, the two suspects apparently got spooked and left the establishment. When police later arrived, they were able to acquire descriptions from which they created composite sketches. Chief Borelli expressed that, while they very much wanted to speak to those two, they didn't necessarily believe they had been involved in the murders and instead considered it possible they may have found the credit card or perhaps had actually met and had dealings with the killer after the fact. According to a 1986 New York Times article, the two individuals, described as an African-American male and female, successfully purchased the Walkman and were gone before investigators arrived, once again leading to composite sketches. Now, the Weekly World News reports very similar details to the Times, though they claim the purchase attempt took place on May 31st rather than June 2nd. The Encyclopedia of Unsolved Crimes, written by Michael Newton, also lists the date as May 31st, but in its coverage, the two suspects were actually questioned by police, who, despite all efforts, could not definitively link them to the murders. In a later New York Times article, though, it said that while the composite sketches were circulated, police never managed to positively identify anyone. So, did police speak to the suspects? Did they find the suspects? Do they know who the suspects are? I suppose that all depends on which source you trust the most. Unfortunately, following that particular incident with the credit card, there has never been another development in this case. Less than 2 months after the murders, Chief of Detectives Joseph Borelli was replaced and returned to his previous post working in Queens. The new chief, Anthony Volker, doesn't show up in any articles discussing the murders of Janet Scott and Ruth Potdevin. In fact, this case doesn't show up anywhere again. There are no news articles about it after 1986. There's no mention when the Dorset Hotel was demolished. There's not even discussion of it in relation to the October 23, 2014 hatchet attacks in which Zale Thompson charged at a group of police officers with an 18-inch metal hatchet. Nor is it mentioned in a more recent crime, the 2019 murder of Brooklyn resident Savannah Rivera, who was killed by Jerry Brown with an axe. There are not a lot of details available in this case. Police don't appear to have spoken about it for more than 34 years. In terms of evidence, there doesn't appear to be much, if any. Maybe fingerprints. But it's hard to imagine that after all this time, there's never been a match. How likely is it that someone who kills two people with an axe in such a brutal fashion doesn't cross the law again? What we do know is there was never a third attack. These two crimes, permanently linked together by both the elusiveness of the killer and their gruesome horror, remain unsolved. For the families, perhaps justice seems like an impossibility at this point. They have sadly become just two of the more than 9,000 unsolved homicides which have taken place in New York City since 1985. Janet Scott's remains were taken out of New York, and she was laid to rest in Paradise Memorial Gardens in Scottsdale, Arizona. 7 years later, in 1992, Her older sister Helen passed away at the age of 93 and was interred alongside her. As for Ruth, I wasn't able to track down the location in which she was laid to rest. One of her sons, Roger, passed away after an illness in 2005. 8 years later, Robert himself died at the age of 86. Just last year, in February of 2019, Ruth's older brother, George Jr., passed away at the age of 93. All these years gone by, so much time needlessly taken and lost, all because an unhinged killer decided to steal the lives of Janet and Ruth. 35 years have now passed, and while New York City continues moving forward, changing faces and lifestyles, the ghosts of memory strive for acknowledgement of two women who met such violent and vicious ends. Their families have surely never forgotten, and somewhere beyond the bright lights, their killer has likely not forgotten either. Life can be stressful even under normal circumstances, and 2020 has certainly raised the bar. You need stress relief that goes beyond quick fixes, and that's Headspace. Headspace is your daily dose of mindfulness in the form of guided meditations in an easy-to-use app. Headspace is one of the only meditation apps advancing the field of mindfulness and meditation through clinically validated research. So whatever the situation, Headspace really can help you feel better. Overwhelmed? Headspace has a 3-minute SOS meditation for you. Need some help falling asleep? Headspace has wind-down sessions their members swear by. And for parents, Headspace even has morning meditations you can do with your kids. Headspace's approach to mindfulness can reduce stress, improve sleep, boost focus, and increase your overall sense of well-being. As someone who isn't great at managing stress, I could certainly use some guidance, and Headspace made it both easy and fun. I love how simple it is to follow the guided meditation with just a tap, and the infographics made it completely stress-free. Headspace is backed by 25 published studies on its benefits, 600,000 five-star reviews, and over 60 million downloads. Headspace makes it easy for you to build a life-changing meditation practice with mindfulness that works for you on your schedule, anytime, anywhere. You deserve to feel happier, and Headspace is meditation made simple. Go to headspace.com/trace. That's headspace.com/trace for a free 1-month trial with access to Headspace's full library of meditations for every situation. This is the best deal offered right now. Head to headspace.com/trace today. For many of us, the holidays will look different this year. Family and friend reunions might not be the same, but that shouldn't stop us from feeling close. That's why I'm giving my loved ones the most meaningful gift this year, a chance to tell their story and share memories using StoryWorth. I absolutely love how StoryWorth creates a lasting, powerful experience with those I love, and teaches me things about them I'd never known. StoryWorth is an online service that helps your loved one share stories through thought-provoking questions about their memories and personal thoughts. It's a fun new way to engage with your family, especially those you can't see in person. Every week, StoryWorth emails your family member different story prompts, questions you've never thought to ask, like, what's a small decision you made that ended up having a big impact on your life, and if you could see into the future, what would you want to find out? After 1 year, StoryWorth will compile all of your stories, including photos, into a beautiful keepsake book that's shipped for free. I plan to keep all of my StoryWorth books and continue to build on them to have something to look back on with joy and to pass to future generations. Give your loved ones the gift of spending time together wherever you live with StoryWorth. Get started right now with no shipping required by going to StoryWorth.com/trace. You'll get $10 off your first purchase. That's StoryWorth.com/trace for $10 off. Two women brutally murdered less than half a mile apart within 5 days. Janet Scott lived in the Bryan Hotel and was killed when it's believed she walked in on a robbery in progress. Ruth Potdevin went to change clothes and maybe also walked in on a crime in progress, for which she paid with her life. Two violent and brutal murders committed in two vastly different environments. A low-cost live-in hotel and a top-tier luxury hotel. Other than the method of the murders and the so-called ritual, these are two women who didn't have a great deal in common. One was 85, the other 58. One lived alone, the other had a large family. One was flush with wealth, the other not so much. Maybe it's not about what they had in common and just more so where they happened to be at that time. While I was researching this case, I couldn't help but think axe murders can't be all that common, and maybe in 2020 they aren't. But in just the year of 1985 alone, I found 12 instances in which people were murdered with axes in the United States. I have no idea what that number would have been had I gone worldwide. In almost every one of those cases, the killer was caught. Either a witness heard or saw something strange and called it in, or the weapon was found with prints on it, or the killer turned himself in before police had to look for him. But not these two. For Ruth and Janet, their killer's never been found. There's not a lot of different theories to address. Frankly, there are no theories. I haven't found a single account of police speculating about the suspect, nor is there any online discussion because for the most part, no one seems to know about this case. There doesn't appear to be any link between Ruth and Janet. They didn't know one another and they were living in extremely different worlds. Ruth, in fact, lived in New Jersey and was only in New York for her husband's convention. New Jersey isn't exactly far from New York, so it isn't completely out of the question the killer could have known both of them, but in all reality, there doesn't appear to be anything to make that seem likely. The murders in and of themselves seem to be random. In both cases, there appeared to be an intent to commit robbery. In both cases, it's believed the victims walked in on their killer. Of course, I can't help but wonder, who exactly brings an axe or a hatchet or whatever if the only intention is to rob a place? Now, in Ruth's case, I can buy a robber a bit easier. It's the middle of the day, it's a fancy hotel, you'd expect people to be out of their rooms seeing the sights or doing something. With Janet Scott, though, it was clear she lived at the Bryan. It was also apparent, given her living situation, that she was unlikely to have a lot worth stealing, let alone worth killing for. One thing I've wondered is, why an axe? As a former resident of New York who frequently visited Manhattan, I can't once recall seeing anyone walking around with an axe or a hatchet. There's other options, and especially in the 1980s, anyone with street knowledge of the city would have known where to get a gun under the table. Surely that would have been faster and easier, though it also would have been louder and more likely to draw attention. It also may have somehow ruined the killer's fantasy. It seems clear based on what he did to the bodies post-mortem that he had some bizarre experience he needed to fulfill. However, I have sometimes wondered if this could signify that the killer was from out of town and maybe visiting. Maybe he had an axe or another weapon with him, maybe in his car if he drove into Manhattan. Both hotels were within quick walking distance of Times Square, somewhat marking them as tourist areas, but that may just be the lens of having grown up in New York after that was all cleaned up. In the mid-80s, Times Square wasn't a great place to hang around, and there was a lot of crime in that area. I could certainly convince myself the killer was from out of town, but it wouldn't be difficult to change that perspective. Maybe someone working in the area, maybe someone familiar with the operations of either or both hotels. A delivery person, room service, janitor. Hard to say, really. Then there's the question of how. How did the killer get into both locations without being seen? How did he bring that kind of a weapon with him, and how did he get out afterwards without being noticed? You'd imagine, given the types of wounds inflicted, that there would have had to have been a high level of blood spatter to contend with, yet there's no reports of a guy walking down 54th Street covered in blood. While we don't know for certain what time Janet was killed, we know Ruth was attacked in broad daylight. In at least one axe case I researched, the killer wore gloves and coveralls which he disposed of afterwards. And that's a possibility here. If the killer had warned them walking in, people might have thought he was a repairman, or they wouldn't have noticed him at all, knowing New York. Afterwards, it's simply a matter of stripping the coveralls off. There's no real place to easily dispose of them, at least not in the hotels, so maybe he took them with him. I can't help but envision this guy carrying a suitcase. He's going into hotels, a suitcase isn't going to stand out. Have your outfit in there, change in and out, and hell, it's even an easy way to carry the weapon without anyone noticing, and if you get a good haul from the theft, you have a way to carry all of that too. Did he just walk down the street, or did he park in a garage, or maybe at a service entrance and then just drive off afterwards? I guess it's a question of motive. Was it always about robbery and the murders were secondary, or was this guy looking to kill people? If he's carrying an axe around, then it's difficult for me to believe it's just robbery. I mean, you could just carry a knife and that's going to get the job done too, but that doesn't seem to be enough for him. Plus, police acknowledged he left items of value behind. Between the weapon used, the ritual, there's something more to all of this. I can't help but wonder, did he get caught in the act, or was he just waiting for someone to walk into those rooms? In Janet's case, it wouldn't have been difficult to learn her routine. She was always there. So if it was purely about stealing, why not go when you know she's not in her room? In Ruth's case, it's a bit more complicated. There's no real way to know when she'll be coming or going, but considering the luncheon was happening at the same time as the murder, it's possible the killer assumed she wouldn't be popping into her room during that time. In Janet's case, I think she had to be selected, chosen. She was always there, living on the 7th floor. How many other rooms, how many other doors between the front entrance of the Bryant Hotel and room 717? I don't think someone ends up at her room purely by happenstance. But I guess you could say the same about Ruth in a way. She's on the 5th floor. Why choose that floor? Why choose that room? At the Bryant, you might not know what's behind each door. It can vary. At the Dorset, you've got to assume there's something of value in most rooms. Is it really as simple as everything was random, or could there be something more complex going on here? In all honesty, I don't know, and the absence of solid evidence makes it possible to envision every different scenario. The only real lead that ever developed in this case had to do with Ruth's credit card. We know a man and a woman tried to use the card to purchase a Walkman at a store in Times Square. I think it's interesting to note that the walking distance from the Bryant to the Dorset was approximately the same as the walking distance from either hotel to Times Square. I guess the thing you have to address is, were the people with the credit cards involved in the murders? Police said from the get-go that they were under the impression there was no connection, and that the two people had either found the credit card somewhere or had some interaction with the killer, likely not knowing he was a murderer. I find it difficult to believe that this person would brutally murder Ruth Potdevin only to try and use her credit card days later to buy a Walkman of all things. It never made a lot of sense to me, and I tend to fall into the camp that thinks this guy likely threw that card down on the street somewhere, either because he knew he couldn't use it, or maybe in the hope that someone else would try to use it and divert attention away from him. Now, due to the lack of information, I can't confirm whether or not police ever spoke to the credit card people. At a minimum, we know they got composite sketches, but beyond that, it's a jigsaw puzzle where you don't have all the pieces. If police did speak with them, then I would imagine they were able to rule them out or they didn't have enough to establish a link, but I find it hard to believe they wouldn't have been keeping track of those people either way. If they never did speak with them, well, that makes things more complicated. If the credit people were involved, it would seem more likely to me that only one of them was. This is a grisly, disturbing set of crimes, and it just seems unlikely to me that you're going to have two people who are both into it. I mean, it's possible. I just don't know how likely it is versus only one of them having played a role. Not to mention, there hasn't ever been anything developed which would imply more than one person was involved. Probably easier to walk away unnoticed when you're by yourself and you can just kind of put your head down and keep moving. At the end of all things, the one question which lingers the most for me is, why did it stop? It seemed like these two murders may have been the beginning of something larger, but then there was never a third. Was it a matter of the killer deciding to move on, heading into another state, maybe to do a different string of crimes? Did he get arrested for something unconnected, sent to prison, or could an arrest have made him worried enough to change up his MO? I suppose there's always the possibility that he was killed at some point or died by some other means. Typically, people like this can't just stop. They can fight it, they can try to suppress it, but eventually that hunger for blood is gonna win. And maybe it did. Maybe he went on to kill again and again, just in different ways. Maybe he turned his attention to people who were less likely to receive a task force to try and solve their case. The fact of the matter is, in New York, there's not exactly a lack of people to target. And between the transients and sex worker populations, there are certainly people to target who may never get any major investigation, especially in 1985. But he definitely had to make some changes. We didn't have other axe murders in Manhattan over the next 6 months or even the next few years. But maybe that's because he read the papers and saw that they were linking the crimes together. So what do you think? Were these crimes completely random, or was there something more going on? Did the killer just stop after Ruth, or did he continue killing in a different way? Did he go to jail? Did he get killed? Or is it possible, 35 years later, that he's still out there walking the streets of Manhattan? Think about it. Even if he was 25 at that time, he'd only be 60 today. He may have slowed down. He may have turned his attention in a different direction. But there's nothing that guarantees he hasn't continued committing murders, but by different methods. Maybe he finally got that gun, or maybe he left New York a long time ago. For all of the things we don't know, there are some things we do know. Janet Scott and Ruth Potdevin had their lives stolen for nothing. A senseless and cold-blooded killer did what he wanted to do, and in the process, stole two lives and broke two families. I sincerely doubt there was anything in either woman's possession that they wouldn't have gladly parted with in exchange for their lives. I wish I could say that these two crimes are still being pursued, that the killer is the focus of the NYPD, but it seems apparent the case has grown so cold no one's working on it, or it's something people with a political agenda might want to sweep under the rug as a remnant of the old New York City. That's where you come in. You have the power to bring this case back to their attention, to let others know, and to help keep Ruth and Janet's names alive. Beyond that, over 35 years, there has to be someone out there who has heard this story from the killer's point of view, or has a pretty good idea of who it was. Enough time has passed. Justice is long overdue. Unfortunately, unless someone comes forward, new evidence is discovered or there is an outright confession, the murders of Janet Scott and Ruth Potdevin will remain open, unsolved, and extremely cold. If you're looking for more information about the murders of Ruth Potdevin and Janet Scott, unfortunately, there are not many places I can direct you other than 35-year-old news articles, because it seems like no one's asked questions or mentioned this case in 35 years. If you have any information about the murders of Ruth Potdevin or Janet Scott, please contact the Midtown North Precinct at 212-767-8400. You can also anonymously give a tip by calling 1-800-577-TIPS, and you'll be eligible to receive up to $2,500 if that tip leads to an arrest. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. Did you know that CrimeCon is coming to the United Kingdom and will be in London on June 12th and 13th, 2021? and I'll be there representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. I'm really looking forward to being a part of this amazing event. And if you're considering going, you can use the promo code TRACE21 for 10% off your ticket. That's TRACE21 for 10% off. Visit crimecon.co.uk for more information. Trace Evidence would not be possible without the amazing support of you incredible listeners. So I'd like to take a moment to thank our amazing Patreon producers. Special thanks to Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Astrid Nyer, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, D'Earthy, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Jennifer Winkler, Joni Berkowitz, Kevin Bonham, Michael Draves, Nick Mohar Schurz, Pamela Coburn, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Mascaritolo, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Eve, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. You're all amazing and your contributions are greatly appreciated, as are all patrons. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or visit trace-evidence.com for further information. That's going to wrap things up for this week, but I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.